The Home Show with Sinead Ryan on News Talk.
Hello, you're very welcome along to the Home Show podcast. I'm your host, Sinead Ryan. Coming up this week, the thorny issue of modular homes or garden cabins is back on the political agenda. We'll be finding out what's going on. And would you be bothered with one? The Festival of Gardens and Nature is back in Ballintubbert House in Laois next weekend in time for the Maybank holiday. Festival co-founder Catherine Fitzgerald of Glyn Castle will be joining me later. Single women are more likely to buy a home on their own than single men. And Paul Kinsella, housewife of Drumcondra, on those dead spaces in your hall. If you'd like to get involved in the show today, you can email us at thehomeshow@newstalk.com if you want to get in touch with us during the week. You can find me on Instagram and on X at SineadRyan100. Now, the thorny issue of modular homes or garden cabins is back on the political menu. With planning permissions and taxation easing, the scope for constructing and renting out your garden shed is ever closer. But is it a solution or part of the solution to the housing crisis or a patronising attempt to move your elderly parent or adult child out of your house? Well, to give us his take is Dr. Lorcan Sir, Senior Lecturer at TUD and Visiting Professor of Housing at University of Galway. Lorcan, welcome to the show. Let's start with the premise itself. Building a structure which can function as a one or two bed home in the garden sounds like a good idea for some people.
Yeah, normally you'd need to get planning permission for anything over 40 square metres, Sinead, in your back garden. And you still need to leave 25 square metres of kind of a garden between any structure, or, you know, in the back of your house. So the proposal was that people would be allowed to build up to 40 square metres without planning permission to be used as housing. Like, typically it would be an extension on your house or a shed or something. And the proposers, the people who suggested this, reckoned it could deliver up to 350,000 small homes in people's back gardens, which is patently not really going to be the case. So the government kind of rolled over this one and thought this was a brilliant idea and actually increased the minimum size to 45 square metres that you can build without planning permission to be used as housing. And the original idea that it would be, like you said, you know, for people's, say, parents who were, you know, their kids maybe were living with them, or the daughter and the girlfriend or boyfriend, whatever, were living with them, and the parents might move into the back garden, and, you know, as the kids were saving for deposits for their own houses, they could live in the house and whatever. That was then changed now, so it can be rented out, firstly, on the rent-a-room scheme, so that's typically to a student or something like that, where you could get 14,000 a year tax-free, and now it's a free-for-all. You can rent it out to anybody you want, and still paying the 14 grand tax-free and whatever you can get on top of that. But those tenants won't be actual tenants. They will be licensees. Now, the difference for most people don't know the difference between a tenant and a licensee, but a license is what you get when you go to stay in a hotel or a B&B. You're there under license agreement. And it means, and this is the killer one, right, that your landlord or the hotel owner or the B&B owner can enter your room at any time. You have no rights under the Residential Tenancies Act. You've no place for disputes. Now, you can see where this is going already, Sinead. You know, if the person who owns the house is renting out a kind of a back garden room, but they have the right to enter that room at any time, that's going to be a recipe for disaster.
Okay, it's hard to know where to start, Lorcan, yeah, to be perfectly honest. Right. Yeah. Okay, let's break it down then a little bit, because the first thing that springs to mind, 45 square metres for the unit, 25 square metres left over of garden, that's planning regs. So immediately that tells me only those with large gardens and money to do this can afford to build these yokes. Does that make it a policy for the wealthy rather than the poor?
Yeah, well, this is it, right? You're right in a way. I mean, people with decent enough size gardens, and it's not huge, but, you know, a 70 square metres garden is it massive. But yeah, I mean, it's people who have gardens in the first place and then, say, have the money to do it. Now, on the money front, right, these things are in around these kind of 40 square metre habitable units, and back gardens are around 120,000, 140,000. So in theory, you would think only people who have that kind of cash sitting around could afford to kind of do that. But I also suspect that an awful lot of people will build their own and they'll just do it with whatever materials or skills they have. And you could well end up with all sorts of a kind of shanty towns across back gardens all over Dublin and Galway and large urban areas in particular.
Right.
The countryside is slightly different where That's a real danger. And of course, there's going to be no inspection of these, really.
Now, the minister has said, and we don't have the legislation, we haven't even got the heads of it. So we do know, we are assured that from the government that there will be inspections, there will be regulations to be met. They'll have to be conform to whatever standards apply. And I presume that's about electricity supply, water supply, solar panels on the roof, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So the minister has been busy telling people that the reason that he wanted to do this is to remove bureaucracy and red tape. But these things are so complicated in terms of the landlord-tenant relationship, the building regs.
You have to have it. You have to have layers, don't you?
You will end up with loads more regulation and bureaucracy if these things are to be work functionally. Because even things like sewage and water, parking, can you imagine, right? If 20 of these went up in 20 houses on a street and all these tenants bringing, even if only half of them brought an extra car, you can see the potential for all sorts of disputes on streets with extra people parking cars everywhere. The sewage, the impact on sewage and water, were already at capacity in large urban areas. Disability access has never been mentioned by the government. You know, is this just going to be for healthy people, healthy young people who can walk all over the place? And fire safety in back gardens and terrace houses, how fire brigades get access, all that kind of stuff. So you'll end up, I have a feeling you're going to end up with a huge hodgepodge of even more bureaucracy and red tape.
And is there a concern then at the other end? Because we know, Lorcan, there are rogue landlords out there, no question about it. There are sheds being let out, which shouldn't be let out at the moment. It's certainly not legal to do so anywhere. So is there a possibility then that standards could slip to the extent that anyone goes up to Woody's, buys a shed and puts a bed in it? I mean, is that a real prospect?
It is, actually, yeah. I mean, I think there's a lot of people, the people who will need the rental income aren't the ones who have a spare 120 or 140,000 sitting in their bank accounts. So that's exactly what could happen in a lot of areas, I have a feeling. And then that whole landlord-tenant relationship then is really iffy, I think, if they're not an actual tenant. And particularly, if you think about it, in a terraced house, you'll be having to go through someone's house to get in and out of your own place. And that idea that you're a licensee and your landlord, you can be evicted at a moment's notice, they have the right to enter your property, all this stuff, all those kind of things. I also think, Sinead, that, they financially incentivized this by extending the rental room scheme to this, and then you can get rent on top of that. But I have a feeling what's going to happen here is they're going to create a huge two-tier cash rental economy with this. You know, people won't declare this. Why would you? Because the chances of you getting caught are close to zero, I would reckon.
Well, also, people believe, if this is tax-free, therefore I don't even need to tell revenue about it. And of course, that's not how it works. You have to disclose it and declare it and put it in your tax return and all that kind of thing. It's my understanding, Lorcan, and this may not be your area, but the rent-a-room scheme, which allows you to rent out a room in your home, of which this will now be treated as the same, to somebody and earn rent up to $14,000 a year tax-free. But it is specifically excluded for family members, for children. So if you take out a loan to build one of these yokes in the back garden and your son or daughter goes into it and pays you rent to pay back the loan you've taken out, that won't be tax-free, is my understanding.
So there's two aspects there, right? Are any banks going to give people loans to do this? Right, is the one. Because from a banking perspective, this is quite a risky prospect.
Well, they've said they certainly won't be permitting mortgages on them because there's a title issue, because the homeowner owns the whole garden. So you can't have somebody, a second owner on that property. But they'll certainly give a personal loan or a credit union loan, I would expect.
They would, but would they give it for the full amount for that kind of money? I don't know, but it's an issue that hasn't been thrashed out. And you're absolutely right. But you can't put a family member in it and claim that under the rent-a-room scheme. But who's going to declare that it is a family member? This is what I mean about we're going to, if you go to Spain, you'll see an awful lot of cash economy in the rental sector. I have been that person in Spain when I lived there, paying cash instead of paying it through a bank account, all that kind of stuff. If nobody's going to come and check this out, I mean, and our council is going to be resourced then for all the extra workload this would bring, more inspections, more building regulations to be checked, more, burden on the environmental health inspectors who check the quality of rental accommodation. I suspect not is the answer there.
What do you think is the motivation here in doing this? I mean, you've made it sound like it's a pig in a poke. No matter what you do, it can't help. It's like nearly set up to fail. But the government have, well, at the moment it's a press release and it's a formation of somebody to look at this. But is their plan here behind it? Is the intent decent. I mean, you have opposition parties. I mean, even Sinn Féin are kind of on board with it. Social Democrats, not so much. There's been political backlash from them for sure. Do you think that it's even a small solution to a big problem and that every bit helps?
I think the motivation here is desperation, to be honest with you, Sinead. You know, they're struggling on their social housing numbers. They're struggling on the number of houses that are coming up for people to buy every year. You know, I've spoken to you before that, like, last year, only about 30% of all new houses came up for sale. So they're struggling on a lot of fronts. And to me, this is kind of clutching at straws. This idea was put to them by a lobby group who suggested it could, you know, deliver up to 350,000 small homes. Now, the lobby group's research was ropey, to say that, to put it mildly. And they kind of grasped onto this and kind of ran with it without thinking about the things that you and I are discussing here. You know, building regs, infrastructure, all that kind of stuff. So I think, you know, to me, they're rapidly trying to backfill an idea that they agreed to without thinking it through properly, really. And I think, you know, a lot of these ideas, when you run with something without thinking it through, they can end up making things worse rather than better.
Is there an implication, Lorcan, for the future reporting of homelessness? I mean, could the provision of these temporary properties dilute the real figures of people who actually need permanent homes?
Well, that's a really interesting question. Yeah, I don't know, to be honest with you. I mean, if people are getting housed in one of these things, one of these kind of, you know, garden homes, well, technically they won't be homeless, so they won't get counted on the numbers of homeless anyway. I mean, we have issues, and it's a topic for a different show maybe, but or a different episode. But like, we have a huge amount of issues about how we record homeless anyway. Like, the people that you see on Grafton Street or O'Connell Street at night time or 6 o'clock in the morning, if you're walking through it, the rough sleepers, they're not actually counted in our numbers of homelessness, for example. Mm. And we don't count people couch surfing or staying with their parents or anything like that. We have a huge issue that we undercount actual numbers of homelessness already. So this, you know, if people are staying in somewhere like that and it is homeless, I can't see these being used to house homeless people, though. I have a feeling they're the last people that will end up in these.
Yeah. And like, is there anything that you can see that's of benefit here, Lorcan? I know you are really coming across as this is a terrible idea and it shouldn't be done. I mean, do you think it just might get lost in the buzz of all the other stuff and be quietly filtered away and stuck on a shelf? I mean, there was a policy that was brought out a few years ago. I think Shane Ross was minister at the time, where there was going to be great grants to split your house in two, your four-bed semi. You'd have an upstairs and a downstairs and split it in two. And as far as I know, that never went past the pilot. Like, could it be that something like this just gets quietly pushed to one side, or will it go ahead?
Look, it might well go ahead, but it'll be interesting to see how many people actually do it. And of course, we won't be able to count them because they probably won't report it that they're actually doing it. So we won't know if it's a success or not. But the interesting thing is, right, and Shane Ross's idea, not a bad one either, right? But they're just tinkering around the edges, you need.
Yeah.
And everything comes back to, you just need to get more houses out there, and you need to get more houses out there that people can buy. Like, last year, 98% of all new housing in Dublin City, for example, was apartments, and 98% of those were for rent. That's not what people want. People want homes to buy. And like, there's a fundamental at the core of housing supply in Ireland is people want homes that they can move into, raise families in, stay there for 40 years, pay off a mortgage, leave it to the kids. And they don't want small apartments that are dark and windows on one side that they're paying $3,000 a month.
No, but maybe there's we may have to have a cultural shift here, Lorcan. We've spoken about before, you go to any European capital, you go to Amsterdam, you go to Berlin, you go to London. People do not kind of live like that. They live in apartments that are well serviced with good tenant rights, that, you know, there's plenty of supply and people can live there for a significant period of time. Maybe it's the Irish culture that needs to change on that.
Well, it's financing on the one front because, like, our houses, two-thirds of our personal wealth are tied up in our houses, right? And it's what we leave our kids, if you think about that. But the other thing, and I'll give you an exclusive on this one, Sinead, do you know, let me turn interviewer for a second, do you know the proportion of housing in Dublin City that is apartments or flats? I bet you the number you're going to come is lower than the real one.
I actually wouldn't have a clue where to start, but I would absolutely think it has to be above 50%, because, I mean, where are you putting everything?
Yeah, you're kind of not far. You're not far off at all. Yeah, so the stock, like, typically you get the statistic you hear is only 12% of people, Irish people, live in apartments and flats. Actually, in Dublin City, it's about 43%. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So we're well up there with European cities.
Okay.
And the reason we don't want to rent for life is because, like, in the Irish and English and New Zealand and Australian system, the when your property accumulating value, like, going up in value over the years that you live there, I mean, that's your wealth. We don't, we have savings, but we don't save as much as other countries, for example. But when we die or when we want to retire and move on somewhere else, it's our house,
it's
that's our store.
That's it.
So you can't do that if you're renting all your
life. We want to pass it on. All right. Well, listen, you have lots of views on that, Lorcan, and I'm sure they will continue among you and your colleagues. You'll be writing about this, I know, in the Irish Times on Monday. And I'd say there's lots more to come on that. But for now, Dr. Lorcan, sir, senior lecturer at TU Dublin and visiting professor of housing at NUIG. Thanks for joining us on The Home Show. Now, still to come, where we're staying a little bit with property, because we're going to find out why single women are up to 70% more likely to buy a house on their own than single men. And we'll also be going out into the Festival of Garden and Nature. See you in a few moments.
The Home Show on News Talk. The Home Show on News Talk.
Now, thankfully, we're all able to get out into the garden a little bit more these days, if only to weed the winter away and plant some spring blooms. But if you're looking for a little more inspo, then the Festival of Gardens and Nature comes to Ballantubbert House in Laois next weekend in time for the Maybank holiday. It's a wonderful lineup of speakers, including Ballymaloe's Rory O'Connell, our own Mick Kelly from GIY, who's very often on The Home Show, TV chef Thomasina Myers, and celebrity couple actor Dominic West and his wife and co-founder of the festival, Catherine Fitzgerald, who joins me now. Catherine, welcome back to The Home Show. This isn't just about gardens. I mean, you've lots on.
Oh gosh, we've got lots on. We have a fantastic lineup of speakers who will be talking over the 2 days to inspire us really about the whole of our relationship with nature, our surroundings, the landscape. It's big thinking and wonderful kind of award-winning designers, ecologically led garden designers, experts on trees, on soil, on food, are all gathering to share their gems with us. So we really, really hope people will make it down and enjoy that bank holiday with us.
Indeed. And you've attracted some big names here now across the world of nature, food and art. Who are you most looking forward to seeing next weekend?
Okay, gosh, that's a difficult question, Sinead. Well, obviously, I love our own Jimmy Blake, who his garden, Huntingbrook, is one of my absolute favourites. His plant combinations are second to none. And he's actually going to be speaking about planting. So don't miss him. And then we've got Dan Pearson, who's a personal hero, who is very ecologically led garden designer working all over the world in Japan. He takes in what's around, right plant, right place, beautiful naturalistic designs. And it's very special to have him, to welcome him to the festival. He'll be talking to David Maxwell. But there's lots more. And we've got, Joe Thompson. Well, as a garden designer, of course, I'm crazy about all these designers. She won Chelsea Gold last year, talking about, you know, mental health, helping female prisoners through the Glasshouse charity to get back to work through horticulture. And it was a winner. It was gorgeous. So she's going to be talking to Callie Hamilton-Stobe of the Glasshouse Project, showing how horticulture can heal. More than that, we've got Healing Herbs from Helen Begadon, who runs the Irish School of Herbal Medicine.
She's a bit of a superstar, isn't she?
She's a bit of a superstar, and we can all learn. Just putting rosemary in our water is giving us so many wonderful, essential things that we need. So we've got all those tips we're getting. And, of course, the wider thinking about regenerative farming, about land restoration. What is land restoration? What is rewilding? I think young people are really keen on thinking about our relationship to our surroundings now, because we are in a bit of a crisis moment, a bit of a problem we've got with our environment, and we need to learn more.
We do indeed. And I know we had Mick on the show, Mick Kelly from GIY in Waterford a couple of weeks back, and he was talking about the importance of being able to grow our own, not to be kind of all the good life and self-sustaining, but actually just to be able to create the essentials where we can, even if it's only a few herbs or a few seed potatoes, like just to make us, it's not to kind of fill our fridges, but it's to make us feel a little bit more in control.
I think so. I think it, I mean, you know, I think, and it's a joy, as you say, it's just, it's such a joy to grow. Once you start, you can't stop, and it becomes a slight obsession.
Yes.
It's incredibly sustaining, you know, all that, the fruit, the flowers, the vibrancy, you know, when we start to make resilient soils, which sing, which hum with life, when you pick up a stone and you see all that life going on in good soil, it's so healing and nourishing. And, you know, this is the kind of what we want to spread and get people excited about and joining in. And it's spring and the leaves are filling with chlorophyll. Everything's green. And, you know, we want to celebrate that and invite people in. There's just so much good information that we've got that we're so keen for people to share.
Now, you are involved in the organising of this, and I know it's a huge, big job to pull it together. Do you have time to give a talk at this? And if so, what is it about? And what will Dominic be bringing to the party?
Oh, gosh, yes. Well, I'm very excited because a personal favourite gardener is Tom Coward of Gravetye. I don't know if you're keen on William Robinson, but he was a famous Irish gardener who went to the UK in the 1870s, wrote a book called The Wild Garden, which is still so relevant today. It's insane how prescient it was about combining native and exotic plants in a natural way that feels right in the landscape. And Tom Coward is the head gardener at Gravetye Robinson's house, which is now a hospitality, a restaurant, so on. And he is gardening in the Robinsonian way, bringing it up to date. And he's going to be speaking. And I'm just so excited to be introducing him. I don't think he needs much prompting because he's got wonderful talk, which he gives, which will explain also about Robinson's influence in Ireland, which was huge, I think, because our climate really suited what he was doing with our lots of rain. And we can grow a lot of, you know, our temperate climate with a lot of a large range of plants and trees. If we think of gardens like Mount Usher, Doreen, Mount Stewart, all those wonderful kind of glorious melange, were all so much of it inspired by William Robinson. So I'm really excited about that. And then Dominic, who is a big nature enthusiast, digger of ponds, ponds, of course, bring so much wildlife back into the garden. Mm. And he's talking to a personal hero of his, Adam Nicholson, who writes about birds, amongst other things. But he's got a book out called Bird School, and it's all about our native garden birds. And you know that joy when you go out in early spring and you hear all that bird song.
Yes, yes.
And you know, we're losing a lot because of our farming systems, because of not planting enough cover, enough trees. So, you know, it'll be talking all about that. And Dominic is definitely an amateur, but an enthusiast. So he'll be, you know, as we all are, but he's coming from more of a wanting to learn point of view, and Adam will be explaining. So he'll be brilliant.
Wonderful, wonderful. Now, visitors won't go hungry either. There are some pop-up food stalls.
Oh, gosh, fantastic food, artisan food and coffee, the best quality. Minnie and I, my partner, I should say, Minnie Preston of Ballintubbard, has been working 24/7 to pull all this together practically as well as curating. But she has got a lineup of beautiful food sellers and have a glass of cider in the apple orchard, homemade cider made at Ballintubbard. And then, of course, shopping. We can't not have a spot of shopping. And we have chosen our favourites. We have, of course, books from Tig Mays, Herbert and Mays. Anthea and Tig will be back selling books by many of the speakers. And then we've got a bit of clothing. We have gorgeous homewares. And then if we're, you know, fed up of shopping and eating, there's also how-to section, and you can get some practical done and weave a bird feeder out of willow with Sarah Jenkinson. So really, it's just all about fun as well, having a good time, meeting friends.
Putting your visitors to work. All right. Well, look, people can find out more at the Festival of Gardens and Nature.com.
Yeah, you can go on Eventbrite or look on the website.
Okay, and there are tickets available for the Saturday and the Sunday, or a bargain weekend ticket, £170, and it covers both days. And you get to see all of those speakers and eat all of that food and make all of those things. Catherine Fitzgerald, I wish you the best of luck. Everybody will be exhausted at the end of it. Thanks a million, Catherine, for joining
us. Thanks so much for having me.
Now, single women are more likely to buy a home on their own than single men. In some cases, 70% more likely. That's the research from leading estate agent in Dublin who has been tracking the data for nearly 20 years. And he joins me now. Owen Riley, welcome to The Home Show. Now, listen, it's hard enough for any person on one income to buy a home these days. Why are women better at it?
For over a decade now, myself and my colleagues have noted that we are dealing with more single women buying than men. And the data now confirms that. And we believe that this is a trend that's going to increase. And to just give you some context on that, in the first quarter of this year, 68% of our single buyers are women, compared to 55% last year. So this is a trend that can be, seems to be growing. And it would appear that single female buyers are more decisive and more motivated to buy on their own.
Interesting. And why do you think that is? Do you think it's maybe the men are happier to share, house share for longer, or that they need a nudge from a woman to say, would you get yourself sorted and get on the property ladder?
We could be talking ambition here. We could be talking maturity. Maybe women are more motivated to secure their financial stability or gain more autonomy. So I'm only speculating here, but this is what I think it seems to motivate single female buyers more than the male ones.
What is the average age for a single buyer compared to a couple buying a home?
The average age of our buyer in general is 41, and the average age of our first-time buyer is 35. And that age obviously has been getting increasing every year. I mean, it seems like it's not that long ago the average age of a first-time buyer we were dealing with was 31.
Yeah, because and is the difficulty, Owen, getting the deposit together, or is it the search for that elusive property? Because there are supports available that make the process of getting the deposit a lot easier than it used to be. Where do you think that delay is coming from?
I would probably say, honestly, earning. Our average selling price in quarter one was €695,000. So these are high-earning women we're talking about here, who maybe have spent the last 10 years really focusing on their career, increasing their earning capability, and of course, saving for the deposit. We do find them particularly active in Dublin 2 and Dublin 8, where average selling prices are maybe a little bit lower than, say, Dublin 4 and Dublin 6. Mm. But I would say it's a focus on their career, it's a focus on growing their deposit and growing their earnings.
I'm sensing, and maybe you can confirm this or not, and I don't want to kind of make sweeping statements, certainly not genderized one, but is it there? I'm sensing a diligence among these female single buyers that it's like, here's the goal over here and I'm going to make sure I'm on the path to get there as quickly as possible. Is that your sense from talking to buyers and applicants?
Well, some of the female buyers that I have spoken to, it seems they were motivated to control their living situation. So, for example, they didn't want to live with friends or strangers in their 30s. They wanted to avoid a scenario where their rent was being increased regularly, for example. They wanted to put their own stamp on their home with their own furniture, their own paint schemes, so to speak. So I think that it was, from speaking to them, I think it was just to create that stable environment for themselves.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And tell me then the extent, Owen, that you're seeing across the board where we've seen data from the Central Bank, which has shown that 4 or 5 in 10 people, a significant proportion, bring gifts, maybe from parents, to this property purchase. Are you seeing that those same figures? Do gifts play an important part? Because obviously that's only one segment of the market that can afford to do that.
Yes, to be honest. We are seeing some buyers receive significant gifts from their parents. And in fact, there are pockets of South Dublin where you wouldn't have a housing market unless some buyers were getting a gift.
Yeah. So it's like an early inheritance drop.
Yes, very, very much so. And you know, this is something that's happening earlier, and I think it's in reaction to the housing crisis and the level of price inflation. So, you know, a lot of buyers, they want to live in the kind of home they grew up in and the neighborhood that they grew up in, and their children to have the same, I suppose, life that they had.
Are you seeing anything like the increase in supply that we need own in the market? I mean, you're big in Dublin apartments. You're kind of in pretty much every postcode. Are you seeing any shift at all that we can look to with any kind of hope?
Well, in the new home sector, there are some encouraging signs in terms of building starts notices. So that's encouraging. Nothing to the level that we need. And unfortunately, a lot of those new homes won't be built in the areas of Dublin that I operate in. And I wish I could be more positive, but the spring has been very disappointing in terms of supply.
It's down
8% on the same period last year. And would you believe it's down 35% according to myhome.ie for the same period in 2019. Which some people refer to as the last normal period. So unfortunately, we're in the height of selling season now and supply's picked up a little bit, but not the same as previous years. So that supply is just so tight. And despite all the uncertainty in the world that we're all dealing with now, selling prices are still very strong. Demand is very robust. So I wish I had more positive news on that front.
Okay, well, we were talking at the top of the show with Dr. Lorcan, sir, about the modular homes in the back garden cabins and what they're going to look like and what's planned and who's going to own what and all of that. Like, do you see movements like that, government policy changes? Is that like a gimmick or do you see that as great? That's something solid that we can hang our hat on that's moving this market a little bit for first-time buyers?
I think it's one small lever that would help. I think we need to be moving all the levers, and I think we need multiple solutions or pathways. Like already, we have a couple of clients who intend to build one of those modular homes in their garden and allow one of their children to move into the main family residence. So it will move the lever a little bit. Obviously, we need to come up with other ways to encourage people or allow people to trade up and trade down. Like I'm dealing with homeowners every day who would love to trade up or trade down if something was available that was suitable for them in their neighbourhood. So I think it will help, but just a little bit.
All right. Okay. Well, on that note, we will say every little helps and hope that there is some significant movement in the market in 2026. And meanwhile, Owen Riley, Managing Director and Property Agent, continue talking to those ladies and give them all the help that they need to get on the property ladder. And thanks for joining us on The Home Show today. Now, coming up after the break, Housewife of Drumcondra, Paul Kinsel is joining me to talk about those dead spaces up your hall stairs landing. See in a few moments.
The Home Show on News Talk. The Home Show on News Talk.
Now, there's areas of the house that we cover quite a lot on The Home Show. We do bedrooms and we do kitchens and we do downstairs loos and all that. But from time to time, we kind of come across a dead space, a kind of space that everybody has and nobody really knows what to do with. And in my home, and I think in a lot of homes, that is that area where the hall meets the landing. So we have the stairs and the staircase, but it's about the space around that, what you do with it or whether you should be doing anything with it. It has to be very functional, loads of traffic through it, but can it also be stylish? Well, here to tell us all and give us some ideas is Paul Kinsler back in with us on The Home Show. Hello,
Thank
Paul.
You so
How are
much.
You?
I'm good. And you?
Good. Not too bad. Now, this kind of space, you come in your front door.
Yeah. It can be a hard space for people to kind of wrap their head around what to do in those kind of areas.
Yeah.
Because again, depending on it, you could be quite tight on space. So sometimes you have to be really clever in what you put into it so it doesn't become overburdened with like furniture. So it's all about like clever style and pieces, in my opinion.
Yeah, because it can become very cluttered very easily. The minute people kick off their shoes, throw a coat on a, you know, over a chair on a rack, drop their car keys,
everything,
bags, you know, and suddenly it feels that all you want is nothing bare and it can be hard to get that mix.
Yeah. So like, let's start with you've just come into your hall. and your stairs is on your right hand side. So what is that space look like? So in my house, we're met by a radiator straight away. Mm. So that already starts going, okay, that's not the most sightly thing. So yes, you can buy the likes of radiator covers to put over it. But I've started to see a lot of homeware brands now do are like small, slim console tables. So you're talking like only 20 to 30 centimetres in depth. So it's something that can go quite flush against the wall and then kind of go over the radiator if you're opting for something that doesn't cover up the radiator completely.
Yeah, it is a tricky one because, I mean, goodness knows with the cost of energy at the moment, if you don't want to cover up any heat that you have. And you do need because it's very cold. Like in the winter, certainly it's very cold. So I love the idea of a console table because they are very shallow.
Yeah.
But that also limits what you can do with it.
Well, I think you have to just then think about what. So if you step back and then go, what do I use this hallway for? So if it's like what you're saying in terms of coats and it's maybe your keys or for in our house, it's sunglasses. That's where sunglasses just accumulate. Then you can start to go back into the rule that we talked about, which is that styling rule and going in kind of the pyramid. Mm. So what you would try to start to do with that space is you'd anchor it with maybe a mirror. And then what we have is we actually have a marble tray that holds all of our sunglasses on it. And then I've paired it with like a little vase with some pampas and then like one or two room sprays. So you're kind of making it functional but look aesthetic. And there's those little things that you can do that makes it work and feel lived in but classic.
So rather than saying get rid of the sunglasses and the keys, you're saying, well, look, if we're going to put them all here, let's make a feature out.
Let's make it functional. And even if you don't want to go with a console table, I've seen for the likes of keys, you putting a floating shelf to the side and hooks underneath it.
Mm.
So then it gives a destination for the keys to go rather than them just being everywhere.
That's a great idea. And of course, then you can put something on the shelf. That's
a lovely faux plant in my house because I kill the plants. I'm a plant killer. Or even again, another styling moment in odd numbers. So like maybe a big vase, a small plant, and then something in between sizes. So we're getting that triangle look again.
Yeah, the rule of three.
The rule of three or odd numbers.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So storage can be important in a hallway as well.
Yes,
and
definitely.
I think if people, I kind of have, well, it's pretty useless because nobody uses it, but I do have a box where I hope and expect and want people to put their shoes.
The shoes in?
Sometimes mine are the only shoes in there.
Yeah.
So I do a passive aggressive thing where I walk the shoes up the stairs.
Oh,
one on each step.
I see.
Again, people just get cross.
Okay.
But kind of blanket boxes or stuff for that. Like, how can you encourage the...
Yeah, so I've seen actually a lovely hack where, I don't know, in IKEA they have a Kallax unit, which is that box kind of cube. We've seen the big box cubes that
you put
the insert baskets in. So you get a much smaller version, you get a 2-1 and you turn it horizontal so the boxes are on top of each other, stick some legs on it, and then you can actually make kind of nearly a pedestal or a plinth that you would incorporate your bottom box would have your shoes in it, and the top box is great for like, do you know, your recyclable bags, the dog lead, all those things that start to accumulate around that area, make it functional for you. So it could change depending on your household and what you use. Then at the top of it, a lovely vase.
Brilliant, brilliant. All right, I'm definitely going to give that up. Anything that makes them understand. Now, up the stairs then. So like whatever about the staircase itself, you have this, for most people, it's actually a very large wall.
Yeah, really large wall. And some people never know what to do with it.
Yeah.
So this is great for... Typically, what we see now is gallery walls on it. And again, with the gallery wall we've talked about before, I would map it out before you do it. And you can use old newspaper or brown paper just to map out the sizes of each frame and make a story as to what it wants to be.
Progression of kids.
Yeah. Moments in that's in your family, like family moments that are big. Or it could just be kind of going to Dezino and getting a colour story that sits in with your hallway if you don't like to have that personal element on show. Depends on what you like.
Now, we've covered gallery walls, Paul, and gallery walls are lovely when they're done, right? Mm-hmm. They're beautiful. They're hard enough to do on a flat wall, which is a square.
Yeah.
On a kind of wall that's a parallelogram.
Yes. Yes.
You have to get the mat head on, don't you?
Yeah, but also I feel sometimes with people, they overthink gallery walls.
Yeah.
I think the best thing to do is I'd always start with maybe two really large frames. So we're talking about A2. Then go into your 30 by 40, maybe just have three of them. And then have a mixture of A4s, so 21 by 30, and then A5s.
Do you need to keep the same distance between all the frames? Because that can be challenging.
It can be really challenging. But look, I feel depending on your style, you can get away with not having it. Or in some states, you might have, I always think about it of a bit like Tetris. So I anchor maybe the really big piece first.
Yeah.
And then I kind of work the smaller pieces around it. And yes, the distance mightn't be exact, but if you go by your eye, you can get a rough guide. Or what I find is if you use maybe a piece of wood that has the same diameter, you can kind of plan it between the frames.
Okay. Now, so the side of the stairs, yeah, or the top of the stairs, a lot of people have a window there.
Yeah, so actually I'm a bit different. My window is actually on the side of the stairs, and at the top of the stairs, I've put a massive mirror. Because immediately what that does into the space is it bounces light around the hallway upstairs, and it gives you that sense of space. So again, you can depend, you can flip it. So if you have a window up there, again, maybe this is just a case where you have a nice plant, a nice indoor plant or faux plant for my plant killer friends out there. And that just brings a bit of life. I think greenery on the stairs is great. If you're attuned to it, because it just brings a bit of life and flow into the room.
And the window itself.
Yes.
I mean, do you want to make a feature out of that or just have it just provide light onto that staircase?
Totally dependent on your style. For me, I don't really like putting a huge amount of things on windowsills.
Mm.
But if you are going to put things on windowsills, I think stick with that. Three is the magic number for me on windowsills, or singular, so a singular piece.
Yeah.
I know in the bathroom I have like a little, in our window, I have a faux plant, a small little ornament, and then a fragrance spray.
Okay, now let's talk about colour.
Yes.
Because the hall, a lot of hall stairs landing, it's just the default is pale.
Yes, of course.
Just pale, open it up and leave it be. And it's kind of unloved to a large extent. And we keep all our colour options for the living room or the bedrooms or the kitchen or whatever.
Yeah, so I feel there's two aspects. You can use paint, or you can also, the likes of Cocoon or Jisc have lovely runners that can go into your hall that can bring some colour into it. That can give it that life. But one trend I'm starting to see now on Instagram especially is people are painting your window alcove a different colour to draw. So it might be like, I've seen one in a really beige room, an orange painted orange windowsill, and it just brings a real pop of colour and fun into the room.
And are you painting the sill and whatever depth you have in the window.
Like,
so you're colour drenching just the window.
Just that frame. Just literally the frame that goes around the window. You're leaving the window alone because we're not painting no windows. But it's just to give a really interesting part. It's kind of, I think we were discussing earlier, it's a bit Mediterranean. It feels a bit fancy.
It is. And you could pick a cerulean blue. Cerulean blue is in.
Yes,
Devil Wears Prada is back.
Devil Wears Prada,
yes.
She's back.
Or you could do kind of a lovely yellowy orangey toning. Or 100%. Green actually works very well.
And if you're very bold, I've watched on the House Revival shows, they've said there's always a moment if you put red in a room, it gives you that moment of, oh, they're arty. They're very arty and fancy.
Right. Mm. Okay, so you could kind of have the neighbours talking you up.
A little bit. Yeah.
Okay, so that's that is a bit bold. But actually, look, we've spoken about this before, Paul. When it comes to paint, it's just paint.
Yeah, it's paint. If you don't like it, you can paint over it.
Yeah.
And nowadays, you can go into a lot of the paint makers and you can get like a 500ml pot. So you don't have to go and buy a 2.5 litre.
Yeah.
Just to do a top up or a colour.
Yeah.
And what I'd always say is try to buy, if you're painting a bigger room like that, I'd always try and go with a 5 litre, because if you're ever doing touch ups, you have the same paint that's gone on the wall.
Yeah, there is a colour match thing. It's a bit like bottle variation in wines.
Totally.
There's a tiny difference between every pot.
Totally.
So keeping some, having more than you need.
And testers are a little bit different to the actual colour you've bought. Yeah. So just always be aware of that.
Yeah. Are you a fan of drama in the hall stairs?
You know me. I love a bit of drama. Yeah, so like for me, drama in it, like I've seen some beautiful, our friend actually has a colour-drenched dark hallway and it's grey all over and her ceiling is like a very light pink.
And that's brave.
Yeah, but it really works.
Yeah.
It really, really works. And again, it depends on how you feel as a person because maybe, as we've talked, colour can be quite scary for people at the start. But I think once you get the colour bug, you start to experiment a bit more. Now, we can do other things like panelling. That will divide the colour so then you can wallpaper the top or paint the top in a lighter colour and panel the dark and it just gives that kind of levelled up aesthetic version.
And the same caveats about panelling up a stairs.
Oh, I wouldn't now.
Leave it to the experts.
I love DIY. I will not be panelling up on a 45 degree angle. Yeah. I just won't.
No, it would melt your head.
Yeah, melt.
But actually, that is a kind of, I'm not going to say a baby step, but it's a softening of the way that you can do that with colour because you can just drench the panels rather than the wall.
Exactly.
Or have a two-tone.
And I think as well, when you're thinking about if you're doing drenching with panels, drench your skirting board as well. I often see people miss it.
Yes.
And it becomes then, especially, I think there's this culture that we all have white skirting boards and they get kicked. Think about it. It's a high traffic area. Yeah. It's going to get scuffed. It's going to get kicked. I know I've painted my whole hall beige. It was the worst decision ever because you just naturally see scuff marks all the time.
And the last thing you need then is white kickboard showing it all off.
Absolutely.
Yeah. No, I think when we do colour drenching, and I've made this mistake myself, you leave the skirts alone and then that's what your eye is drawn to.
It sticks out like a sore thumb. Yeah. When I drenched my living room, I colour drenched everything. The door, skirting boards, windowsill, everything.
Or not everything. At all. Go big or go home.
Go big or go home.
All right. Well, Paul Kinsler, housewife of Drumcondra.
That's me.
Thank you very much for all of those tips. And you can find Paul and all of his doings at life@number2 is the Instagram handle. And it's full of fantastic videos and a little bit of humour as well. And that's all we have time for on this episode of the Home Show podcast. I hope you enjoyed our mix of guests and commentary. And if there's anything you'd like us to include in the Home Show, please get in touch with us. You can find me on Instagram and on X on social media, and you can email us at thehomeshow@newstalk.com. My thanks to producer Aoife Breen. Stephen McLoone was on sound. We'll be back next week with a new episode to drop. Why not like and subscribe and follow? It's completely free and you won't miss any of our episodes, and we look forward to seeing you next time.
The Home Show with Sinead Ryan, Saturday at 5 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.